You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, and for the rest of the hour, a look at the history and future of organ transplants. Did you get what happened 2 days before Christmas in 1954? Well, that was when a surgical team led by Joseph Murray took a kidney from a man and transplanted it into his twin brother. Remember that? The brother that received the kidney lived another 8 years, and Dr. Murray, the surgeon, went on to win the Nobel Prize in Medicine for his work as a pioneer in organ transplants. And now a little bit of the Wayback Machine to give you an idea of what was going on in those days and the heady time of organ transplants in the early days. Here's Dr. John Merrill. He is a member of that first transplant team. And this is a tape, actually it's a film, I think, talking about the procedure in a 1968 interview.
Well, I think we are all so excited that I don't really think that any of us worried too much about it. There was too much new, too much to be done. We were all so busy. But the thing we did worry about was the first identical twin transplant, because we had reason to believe that this was going to work. And also, it was the first time that anyone had taken a healthy, normal kidney from a living donor. And in addition to all this, it was done on the 23rd of December. Now, you can imagine, in the present climate of heart transplants and all, what would have happened if that first normal, healthy donor had died on Christmas Day. The whole transplant business would have been down the drain for years, certainly.
Of course, that was a successful transplant, and so for the rest of the hour, we're going to take a look at how organ transplants have evolved since that time. Being a twin, the first kidney recipient didn't have to deal with a rejection problem. Advances in immunology since then have allowed organ transplants between people who are not related. And better anti-rejection drugs have helped more people than ever live with their newly acquired organs. But with all these advances, one thing has not changed. The number of people who need organs still far outweighs the number of organs donated. So this hour, we're going to look back. We'll also put on the crystal ball, try to look forward. With advances in stem cell research, are scientists getting closer to making organs? What about using organs from animals, such as pigs? Well, that's what we'll be talking about for the rest of the hour, and you're more than welcome to join in. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let me introduce my guests. Thomas E. Starzl is a retired transplant surgeon. He performed the first human liver transplant back in 1967. He is professor of surgery at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. He joins us from member station WQED in Pittsburgh. Thank you for taking time to talk with us, Dr. Starzl.
Delighted.
Charles A. Vacanti is the director of the Laboratory for Tissue Engineering and Regenerative Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He's also the Van Dam Covino Professor of Anesthesia at Harvard Med School. He joins us from Boston. Thank you for talking with us today.
Well, thank you for asking me.
You're welcome. Dr. Starzl, take us back. I played that little bit of tape from 1968. Let's go back even further. What was it like back in those early days of transplant history?
Well, it was pretty grim because there were more failures than successes.
Mm-hmm. And so people were fearful of trying it?
Well, you could put it in another way. There was an alternative form of treatment, which is dialysis, which, of course, is still there. Responsible physicians and patients, too, had to decide which way to go, whether to try a transplantation, which was thought even then to give a better quality of life if it worked, or to go to dialysis, which was free of immunosuppression.
Mm-hmm. And you did the first liver transplant in 1967. Was there a jump in technology between the first kidney that had done it over a decade beforehand and 67?
No, not really. Not as far as control of rejection is concerned. In fact, liver and kidney transplantation really developed as a kind of partnership. That work was being done with both of those organs mainly at two centers. One was the University of Colorado, the other was the Brigham. And advances that were made with one of the organs was simply transferred over, modified sometimes a little bit, and used for the other organ.
Mm-hmm. And what were the major obstacles in those days?
Well, rejection at the beginning was certainly the principal obstacle. With cadaveric kidneys, unrelated kidneys, only about one in three in 1962 and 1963 lasted for as long as a year, although some of them went for a very long time after that. But even as early as 1963, the one-year survival with live-related transplants, these are not twins, was in the range of about 80%. And that was a huge advance, because between the time of the first allograft success, which was in 1959, up to the spring of 1962, almost 4 years, there were actually in the world were only six examples of survival of allografts for as long as 1 year. Mm-hmm. But suddenly in 62 and 63, it became possible to actually develop series. And that was the beginning, I think, of the great surge in transplantation. And the surge continued in steps that were dictated largely by the development of new immunosuppressive agents, rather a small number of steps, as a matter of fact, mm-hmm. That involved first the development of something called ALG, then the next step was cyclosporin, and the next step after that was tacrolimus. And that really brings us right up to 2004.
Hmm. And there are many more organs that are being transplanted today, though. You got heart, you got lungs, liver, kidney, what else?
All of the organs except for the brain have been transplanted, and that also was dictated by the availability of these new agents. Whenever a new agent came along, it made it possible to do something or add another organ that had never successfully been transplanted before.
Mm-hmm.
So the big movement occurred in 1980, throughout the 1980s, during which liver transplantation, heart, lung became pretty much standardized. And then in the 1990s, the intestine joined the group, and of course there have been some recent successes with pancreatic islets. So throughout most of the history, mm-hmm. it's been contingent on the development of better drugs, and there haven't, as I said, been a lot of those.
Yeah, Dr. Vicanti, you're working on tomorrow's generation of tissue engineering techniques that might make transplants obsolete. Can you tell us something about that?
We certainly are hoping that it will be tomorrow's technology, but yes, I am. We have been working with a mechanism to generate new tissue rather than transplanting new tissue. And basically what it involves is isolating the cells of the particular organ you would like to grow, expanding them in an incubator, and then, as opposed to just injecting them back into the body, to use principles of engineering to deliver those cells back into the body attached to some type of scaffolding in a configuration that will allow the cells to stay alive, to perform their normal function, to generate new tissue.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a very famous picture of an ear that I think it was you who constructed an ear in the back of a mouse, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
What was the purpose of that?
Actually, the actual purpose of the ear was to answer some specific questions from reviewers for the basic concept. But the concept at that time was to, we were working with a specific tissue. In that case, it was cartilage. And cartilage is not only the tissue that you find lining the bones to provide support for walking and allow the joints to flex, but it's also the support structure in your nose, your ears, so it gives you some of your facial characteristics. In this particular experiment, what we did is we demonstrated that you could biopsy a small specimen of cartilage, isolate the living cells from that specimen, which are called chondrocytes, expand those chondrocytes or increase their number in an incubator. And then when you place those cells, the living cells, on a scaffolding, you could implant the scaffolding and the cells back into a recipient in a manner that will allow the cells to remain alive. So as they remain viable, the cells will actually make new cartilage tissue and the scaffolding will disappear. So it was a concept to show that you could indeed generate a new tissue from cell culture using these principles. Initially, when we sent it in for review, the reviewers admitted, yes, you've generated a new tissue, but so what? You know, what is the practical application of generating a new tissue? And in response to that, we generated tissue in a specific shape. So since we were using cartilage as the tissue that we were growing, we thought a good example would be to demonstrate we could grow it in the shape of a human ear. Mm. And that was after talking to plastic surgeons who stated that one of their most difficult tasks was to replace cartilage in a human ear.
Interesting. Could you do the same thing with skin to grow over burn victims?
And actually, skin probably was, in at least present day, the first tissue that was, quote, tissue engineered. Mm-hmm. So some of the early work in the early 80s was actually to replace skin that was lost by burns.
And when will we see, common usage of this technique of using the scaffolding?
Actually, it's being used fairly frequently mm-hmm. now in skin. To use a scaffolding is actually being applied in many different technologies, but on a smaller scale. For example, we talk about islet transplantation. Now, there are different ways to deliver islets. Islets are the functional unit in the pancreas that controls your glucose level in your body.
Make the insulin.
That's correct. Yeah. It makes the insulin, and it's a component that doesn't work well in diabetic patients. So one thing you can do is a pancreas transplantation. A second option you can do is just transplant the islets themselves. Now, you can transplant the islets by injecting them into the body and having them seed out in the liver. Other people have actually taken the islets and encapsulated them in a type of hydrogel mm-hmm. and then implanted them back into the body, with the thought being that the capsule would decrease the immune response to those islets. So that has actually been done to some extent, too.
But it's not a cure at this point.
No, it's not a cure at this point. And that may be, I think one of the biggest reasons it's not a cure is the availability of islets. So it's the same problem with any transplantation, is you need an adequate supply of whatever you're transplanting. I think a viable option in the future is if indeed you can identify the stem cell or progenitor cell, the immature cells associated with the islets, and you're able to grow sufficient numbers of islets in the incubator, then this actually may be a lot more productive. But currently there is a relative shortage of donors.
Yeah. We're talking with Dr. Charles Vacanti and Dr. Thomas Starcel on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Do you suspect that there's a partnership here. You don't view that stem cell research is going to put your way of creating these new kinds of tissue out of business?
I think stem cell, and again, it depends on which component you're looking at, but I think that stem cell biology is absolutely a necessary component of tissue engineering. We found, especially in some of our earlier work, that, again, with the ear being one of the first demonstration that we did in our laboratory, that mature cells will work fairly well in generating new tissue. However, younger cells or immature cells will work much better for several reasons. One of the biggest reasons is you need, in general, to start with a small amount of cells, a small number of cells, and then grow a sufficient number to make the tissue that you want. When we did some of our earlier experiments, we had literally millions and millions of cells, and we made small specimens of tissue. But if you go forward to a practical application, you need to take a limited number of cells and expand those literally to millions or billions of cells to make a larger tissue. Mm-hmm. And I think that you will be more successful doing that with immature cells, some type of stem cell. Mm-hmm. The other thing is when you implant these cells, and a younger cell, an immature cell, is much more viable. It needs less oxygen at the time of implantation than a mature cell. So not only will you be more likely to have sufficient numbers using an immature cell, but you're also more likely to have successful or to have survival and then successful engraftment.
So are you talking about embryonic stem cells here?
I'm talking about stem cells in general. Mm-hmm. The work in my laboratory is actually focused on adult stem cells rather than embryonic stem cells.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get a quick phone call here. Bob in Paris, Tennessee. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was just wanting to interject. I'm looking forward to the next generations of transplantations. I'm lucky to be the recipient of a complete kidney and pancreas I received at Vanderbilt University in 1989.
Still working?
It's working fine.
You're here?
I can sit down with a pot of coffee and a fruitcake and just enjoy both of them thoroughly.
Did you have diabetes?
Yes, I was very brittle diabetic and suffered end-stage renal disease. And then I received an entire pancreas, which was experimental, and the kidney simultaneously, October the 10th, 1989.
And they were not rejected?
They tried to be. OKT3, I think, was the medication that turned it around. But it's been exciting, and I'm alive because of it.
Dr. Starzl?
Yes, sir.
Any reaction?
Well, no, it's a wonderful success. It's rather unusual to have pancreas going for 15 years. So congratulations.
Well, thank you very much.
It's getting better now. It's those were kind of pioneer days for pancreas transplantation.
Yeah, that was the reason that mine was experimental. It was in the early research days of the full pancreas transplant.
Well, thank you for calling, and a good holiday season to you.
Thank you, and the best of wishes to both, all of you there.
Thank
good
you.
Luck.
Interesting. We have a lot more to talk about, so stay with us. We'll come back and talk lots more with Dr. Tom Starzl and Dr. Charles Vicanti about tissue transplants. Maybe we'll get it to see what our guests think about growing organs in other animals, like pigs, and transplanting them into people. Is there a future in that, or maybe stem cells won't maybe make that obsolete? Well, stay with us. We'll be right back. Don't go away. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about organ transplants with my guests, Dr. Thomas Starzl, who performed the first liver transplant back in 1967. He is a professor of surgery at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. Dr. Charles Vicanti is director of the Laboratory for Tissue Engineering and Regenerative Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. Our number 1-800-989-8255. I said before the break we would talk about xenotransplants, transplanting organs from possibly growing them outside of people, maybe in other animals. And I know, Dr. Starzl, you were involved with one of the first modern-day transplants, xenotransplants, of a baboon liver into a patient with AIDS and hepatitis B. Can you tell us about that case?
Well, we did two of those liver transplants from baboons in 1992 and early 1993, and the first of those patients lived for about 2.5 months and had good liver function throughout most of that time. The second one lived for about 1 month, but we had arranged to do four of those cases, and after analysis of the results, what had happened, we concluded that there was a barrier there that we couldn't effectively treat, and that this would require some kind of either genetic modification, even in those higher primate donors or else some kind of medication that did not and does not to this day exist. So we've stopped. Now, there was quite a bit of objection to the use of higher primates as donors and also some concern about infectious disease risks. So as a kind of consensus, people have turned to the use of a more satisfactory donor. The pig has been identified. And the efforts in xenotransplantation have been directed to try to make transgenic modifications in these animals. There has been some progress in that direction, although I think there's a long way, there's a lot left that has to be done.
Why would a pig be better than a baboon?
Well, the baboon actually would be better if it didn't create a sense of outrage about using animals that are so close to to being human. That's one factor. But then it was conceived that the infectious disease risks or the risks of a disease jump from higher primates to man would be more likely than from the lower forms. So I think both factors led to this. I think sometimes this kind of decision is not well grounded. I'm not prepared to say that this one was poorly conceived. But by going to an animal, a mammal as distant from the human as the pig, it certainly creates a much greater task.
There is some speculation even these days that HIV jumped from the eating primates.
That's a speculation. I think that's been largely disproved.
Yeah.
But
and so,
but anyway, that illustrates the problem. In fact, that really is exactly analogous.
Yeah. So where do we stand with xenotransplants? Are people actually actively working in developing them in pigs? You know, hearts, things like that.
I'm sorry. I was interrupted here.
I'm sorry. How far along are we developing xenotransplants, for example, of growing a heart in a pig that might be transplanted to a person?
I think it's we're a long way away from that.
We're away from that.
Yes.
Yeah.
It will be a number of years, I think, before we get to that point.
Dr. Vicanti, in tissue engineering, do you think that would make it unnecessary if you come up with a sufficient tissue to engineer?
Well, you've answered the question. If we come up with sufficient tissue, then it would make it unnecessary. I guess you have to ask what the probability that we will come up with certain tissues within, you know, within defined periods of time. I suspect that for many of the organs, the liver transplant surgeons will not be at risk for many years.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about liver and other organ transplants. To the phone, Steve in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm calling, and thanks very much for having this program. I'm an oncologist here in Portland, Oregon, and I'm aware that the patients that have had kidney transplants and other transplants, after a while of immunosuppressant drugs, there's an increasing incidence of malignancies that have developed in them, in particular non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And I'll really look forward to either some stem cell research and breakthroughs where immunosuppression drugs will not have to be used because there is a heavy cost that's paid down the road in a number of these patients when these other malignancies, and it doesn't have to be just non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. It can be leukemias, it can be other diseases. Our immune surveillance system is so sensitive that whenever it's suppressed, the chances of raising the head of other malignancies develops. And so I'm so glad that you're having this program, and it raises so many issues. And the better off that we are with stem cell research and these other things, I think the less and less often that we may have to use immunosuppression in the future.
Dr. Starzl?
Well, I think everything the gentleman said is correct. One of the main things we're working on here is exactly what that man has in mind. trying to make patients tolerant so they can get off of immunosuppression. And there has been genuine progress along those lines. The achievement of engraftment of an organ is in and of itself a form of partial tolerance. You can use these drugs if they're properly timed and dosed in such a way that the organ itself can induce tolerance to itself. And if that occurs, instead of giving a patient a lot of drugs every day, you can end up giving one or two doses a week, or in some cases stopping therapy altogether. But the trick is how you give the immunosuppression and in what doses during that rather short period of time during the first 30 or 60 days after transplantation. And it never really was understood what was going on during that period until some discoveries were made about a dozen years ago that are perhaps too technical to get into here. But the bottom line is that exactly what he's talking about, that is relieving the burden of immunosuppression and relieving the likelihood of getting malignancies afterwards, is really within our tangible reach.
Now, we know that at least one of the organs that can be transplanted, the liver, can regenerate in the plant, in the person who's the donor, and also it'll get bigger in the person who gets the liver. Is there a way to have a person who's alive donate part of their liver to someone else?
Yeah, well, that's been done with considerable frequency now. I think there have been over 1,000, maybe as many as 1,500 of those cases done, at least half or more of them in the United States. It carries more risk than live donor kidney transplantation, but there are centers that do that. We have a particularly skillful surgeon here named Amadeo Marcos, who does those cases frequently. And there are other centers, but there have been some deaths from of donors from live donor liver transplantation, and that's put a little bit of a damper on going forward full throttle with that kind of treatment. But it's one way out of the organ shortage, and as an immediate expedient, it's one that's being exploited both here and Europe and Asia.
We're talking about organ donating this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. To the phones, Margaret in Mill Valley, California. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. During the recent election on the stem cell brouhaha, I'm a nurse, but haven't gotten a correct answer on this. I was told that adult stem cell lines, you can't, they don't contain them for the pancreas. That's only in the embryos. Is that correct? And if it is correct, then it just seems like there's, you know, we've taken a lot of hope away from juvenile diabetes and brittle diabetes with not being able to use the adult stem cells.
This is a question I can answer. The answer is, it may be correct, but there is certainly no evidence to support that that is correct. I think when you say that you have not identified something to date, you can then extrapolate and say it does not exist. But personally, I believe that actually it does exist. We've done some preliminary studies in our laboratory working with pancreas, and I think that I would say that I have a high degree of confidence that that cell does exist in the pancreas.
Well, that's really encouraging, because I went to a lecture by two physicians who said, you know, there's just nothing there. And so I thought you'd be better to ask. So thank you for that.
Thank you. We've had other researchers come on. I'm trying to remember who it is in particular. Come on and tell us that they have found also that they're, you know, they've been able to regenerate some islets just by taking away and removing there are stem cells floating around in the body someplace that would start to regenerate them if they take the cause of the diabetes away.
And actually, I believe that too. I think with some of our preliminary work, and we've done some work actually with diabetic patients, and it suggests that they may indeed have the stem cells that may, if they're taken outside of the body, be able to regenerate new islets. And And then you could put them back into the patient. Unfortunately, the same disease process
right.
would destroy the islets unless you treated the patient.
Right.
But it may very well be an ongoing, there may be an ongoing attempt by the body to generate new islets that are continually being destroyed.
I think it was Denise Faustman who was on who was talking about that. And so that is, you know, and that's the question. If you don't get rid of the underlying disease, what is the sense of doing the transplant? You know, I mean, that's the wrong way to phrase it, but I would think you'd have to get rid of the underlying disease or it's going to attack the new transplant,
well,
will it not?
But that may not be, that's true, that's exactly true, but it may not be that important. For example, even if you had an ongoing process,
right.
if you delivered sufficient numbers of islets and say you injected them somewhere, you know, safe under the renal capsule, and they're destroyed, if they're destroyed over a long period of time, if it's 5 years, you may have to go in and get a boost of new islets every 5 years that function pretty well as opposed to taking insulin on a daily basis and then having all the side effects of the diabetes. So even if it's not a cure, if you indeed have symptomatic improvement that is much more effective and much more convenient, it's still very good. And then there are ways to go ahead and decrease the loss of those islets, too.
It's interesting because they seem to be finding stem cells popping up in places they never thought before.
I believe that every tissue in the body has a store of immature cells. And again, I think we use the term stem cell sometimes inappropriately. A stem cell, by definition, is a cell that can turn into any other cell type in the body, whereas a progenitor cell is a cell that is committed to the cells of that specific organ. So that it may be baby cells for that organ. And if you think through it, in a lot of ways, you're better off using immature cells or baby cells that are specifically committed for the organ that you want, as opposed to trying to coax a cell to turning only into the cell types of that organ.
Well, gentlemen, I know you're busy, and I want to thank you for taking time to talk with us today and wish you all a happy holiday.
Same to you.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thomas Starzl is performing the first liver transplant back in 1967. He's professor of surgery at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. Charles Vacanti, director of the Laboratory for Tissue Engineering and Regenerative Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Paul Masiello in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music and with help today, as always, and appreciate it from NPR librarians Kim Maleski and Alphonse Finn. If you want to write us, send your letter to Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10036. Surf over to sciencefriday.com. We'll have all the links we talked about today if you missed them. Science Friday's Kids Connection is there. Click on Teachers for free curricula. Also, you can download into your iPod past editions of Science Friday or listen on your Real Audio Player. Have a great, safe weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.